Music by Richard Wagner, the prelude to Act One of his opera, Die Meistersinger, Meistersinger von Nuremberg, or the Master Singers of Nuremberg, if you like, in a performance by the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, conducted by James Levine. And you're hearing it on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Good afternoon, I'm Kevin Kelly. That's the first piece that will be on tomorrow night's concert by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the fourth and final of the candidates who've been conducting all year for the right to be the next music director and conductor of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony. More on that in just a moment or so. I'll be talking with that conductor. Coming up, I'll be talking with one of the two featured performers on a concert presented by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana this coming Sunday night in Champaign that features music by Johann Sebastian Bach, his Art of Fugue. And on that program, harpsichordist Charlotte Maddox and organist Dana Robinson, both of the University of Illinois School of Music faculty. Dana Robinson will be joining me along with the Baroque Artists music director, Chester Always. So that is coming up. But first, the person who I haven't yet named is Stephen Alltop. He is music director of the Apollo Chorus of Chicago, has been for quite some time, I think, the Elmhurst Symphony Orchestra, the Green Lake Choral Institute. He's associate conductor of the Peninsula Music Festival in Wisconsin. And also, he is a senior lecturer in conducting and ensembles at Northwestern University. Happy to say my alma mater. And he also conducts, I didn't realize this, the Alice Millar Chapel Choir, which I used to sing in and had a chance a few occasions to conduct myself. Stephen, thanks for coming in and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kevin. It's wonderful to be here.
And good luck with this whole process. I understand from talking to the previous candidates that you get to talk to all kinds of people, board members, donors, people who you wouldn't think had a stake in the whole thing and, you know, who will have a say eventually. In looking at your bio and what I remember of the others, you have one bit of uniqueness relative to the others, and that is your experience with choral conducting.
Oh.
With choral ensembles. I mean, I think the others have no doubt had done some work with choral ensembles, but you've spent a lot of time with choirs.
Well, I sort of divide my time, and my aspiration, even when I was in school, was to work with both media. I love choral music. I love orchestral music. There are some conductors, John Elliott Gardner would probably be a leading example, who also divide their time in a similar fashion. And my degrees were in choral conducting. My master's degree was in choral conducting, but my doctoral degree is in orchestral conducting. So it's always been my hope to hold the sort of appointments that I'm lucky to hold now. And I love to combine orchestras and chorus in the great masterworks, but I also love to work with the ensembles separately. As a music director, it's really been a big help to be comfortable with choruses. When I was music director of the Cheyenne Symphony for 8 years, from 2000 to 2008, we did a lot of choral music. It's great for the community because it brings lots of people to the symphony, and of course, it's often good for ticket sales, too.
Well, because chorus members tend to be better marketers than orchestra members, I've certainly found.
They often bring their family, it's true, and their friends. But I find that orchestras enjoy playing choral masterworks. I think that it's a type of playing that's different than just pure symphonic playing. There's a host of other considerations, like serving the text, like balance, and generally you're doing music by great composers. Verdi and Bach and Brahms and Mozart, and just these composers poured their genius into those works, and so I find orchestra members really love them.
You also have, again, while the other candidates may do some performing, and I know that David Commande, for example, has done a fair amount of performing as an instrumentalist himself, you've spent a lot of time doing that as well as both an organist and a harpsichordist. Tell me about what some of that experience has been and how you imagine that would inform your time with, this sounds like an interview question, a job interview for a question, which I don't mean it to be.
Well, it's a really great question because it's not unusual for conductors to invest themselves in some kind of what we call applied musical activity, be it playing the piano or singing or playing the violin early in their careers, and then with the demands that come as a conductor and music director to sort of lose touch with that ability. But some conductors, like Daniel Barenboim, for instance, or Christoph Eschenbach, stay active in their performing, and I've tried to do that too. And I love the word you used, inform my activities. I've played a lot with the Chicago Symphony. At the end of the month, I'll be playing with the Milwaukee Symphony. And when I return and sit on the stage as an ensemble member and follow a conductor, and I've had the opportunity to work with great conductors, Pierre Boulez, Lorne Mizell, Roger Norrington, Kent Nagano, Daniel Barenboim, just a host of really wonderful conductors, then it reminds me what orchestral players need. And I think it's tremendously important for conductors to ground themselves in that knowledge, because we must always remember that ultimately we don't make any sound. We influence it. We hopefully serve the composer on the podium. We are, as Eric Leinsdorf said, the composer's advocate there on the podium. But ultimately, it is the musicians who make the sound. And we must serve them as we do the composer. So I find that maintaining my activities as a performing musician, as a keyboardist on organ and harpsichord, and occasionally piano, keeps me able to perform with other musicians. As a music director, I have on many occasions made chamber music with the members of the orchestra. I'm really glad that I never stopped playing, because it's opened up the door to lots of fundraising opportunities, lots of chamber music and Baroque performances. So as I told the search committee when they were asking me interview questions Monday afternoon, I've always been a bit greedy musically. I like to do a great deal.
The fundraisers, meaning that you can go out and play yourself for people who might give the symphony money?
Oh, sure. I love to do concerts in homes. And in fact, just last night, my wife, who's a wonderful soprano, and I had a great time after dinner just sitting down at the piano and opening up a book there of Broadway pieces on the piano and playing. And that was informal, but we've also done that sort of thing. And I have also on many occasions done that in a slightly more formal setting in someone's home. I've played the Goldberg Variations as a benefit for the Peninsula Music Festival. I've played harpsichord concerts in homes out in Colorado as a benefit for the orchestra, and so forth. So I'm always happy to have that opportunity, not only because the music's wonderful, but it's kind of fun for me to make music in a variety of places and to have the audience, the community I work with, see that other side of the music making I like to do.
This question might be a little bit risky to answer, but I'm sort of curious about it because I've made certain observations about this particular topic, and that is, what differences you find between, in your experience as a conductor of both types of group, between choral singers and orchestral players?
That is a great question, and I know that you do work with both ensembles, so I'm sure that you have your own
very
experienced opinion about it. At the start of things, I believe that good conducting is good conducting. When I teach conducting, I try to teach a basic gestural technique that serves any sort of situation. In fact, I often find that choral conductors, unfortunately, sometimes don't come to the podium with the sort of gestural credibility that would help them in front of a professional orchestra. And because sometimes choruses don't demand the same type of clarity, and conductors are a little more, shall I say, freeform in the technique that they use, I really encourage my students to have a technique that will give them credibility in front of any ensemble. Having said that, you do well to know as much as you can about the musicians or the musical forces you're working with. A conductor should understand string technique to as great a degree as possible, and the needs of winds and brass. And early on in my study, I would read books like The Anatomy of the Orchestra by Norman Del Mar that tells you things like, you know, if you put the trumpets right behind the horns aren't going to like it because they'll feel the trumpet sound coming right up the back of their bell, and just all kinds of things. It's endless, as you know, the amount of knowledge that one can have about things. And that's not to mention the intricacies of continuo or early music. But really at the heart of it, I find that singers need a sort of special energy because more than anything, a chorus is like a parabolic mirror, and they will tend to reflect back to the audience the energy that the conductor gives them. So I try to give them that sort of energy. A lot of it has to do with the fact that their music is coming straight from the center of their body. They have no choice. They must involve their body from the very center to make a good sound. Hopefully all musicians do that. They breathe like a singer would, and so forth. But then in a way, there are different techniques of motivation that I employ for the different ensembles. I think humor can be important for both. I'm the sort of conductor who really likes to work hard and seek the highest level of excellence, but to have a good time doing it, because music should be about joy. We all know conductors who utilize fear or terror as a motivational technique, and sometimes you have to crack the whip a little bit. People should respect you, but I think if you're a good musician, they will respect you. And if you make music a joyful experience, then you keep yourself completely open to the full gamut of emotions that is in music.
Just one element of my own opinion about that question. You said that, you know, having a sense of humor in front of either ensemble is helpful. My observation would be that whether your joke is funny or not, the chorus is more likely to laugh.
I suppose that's true. But I've been in countless rehearsals with professional orchestras where just the right humor at the right time was very productive.
It lightened things up.
Yeah.
On this concert, I'll remind listeners that we're talking with Stephen Alltop, who will be conducting the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night. It's the final subscription concert of its present season, earlier than usual, largely because they need to make a decision of these from among these four candidates and then figure out what they're going to do next year. So Stephen Alltop is the last of the music director and conductor finalists, and more on that in a moment. I want to say that today's broadcast on Live and Local is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. I failed so far to say what else is on the concert program tomorrow night. We heard just a bit of the Meistersinger Overture by Richard Wagner. Also, the program will end with a fabulous piece of music by Jean Sibelius, his second symphony, probably his most popular symphony. I've heard others say different pieces, but that's my impression. And then a piano concerto by Sergei Prokofiev, the third concerto. And I sort of forget when talking with the other candidates whether the orchestra had chosen the soloist for you or whether you got a hand in choosing the soloist.
Well, I've been a part of searches where the program was set for you or soloists were set for you. This was actually, I have to say that I think this is one of the best organized searches I've ever been a part of. And also, because they let the candidates submit programs and suggest soloists. And I submitted two programs, one of which really worked in terms of not being, well, I had tried to avoid repertoire that the orchestra had played, but just for whatever reason, the program that we're doing tomorrow night was the one that was most appropriate. And I suggested the soloist, Winston Choi, who is an incredibly gifted young pianist who did his doctorate at Northwestern University, plays all over the world now, and is the head of the piano faculty at Roosevelt University in Chicago, despite the fact he looks impossibly young to hold such a position. But he's an enormous talent, and I just said only an hour and a half ago when we finished going through the concerto how glad I was that Winston would be here for this concert.
Why the Prokofiev Third Concerto?
Prokofiev's Third Concerto is one of those pieces, sort of like the Brahms Second Piano Concerto, or a number of the Mozart concertos, or Beethoven concertos, that really reflects its composer. I don't think there's a piece by Prokofiev that more closely resembles his own musical personality. For an audience, it's a very engaging piece. All three movements just brim and bristle with kinetic energy and excitement. There are also some moments of great poignancy. There are places that really remind me of the Rachmaninoff Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. Sometimes I think we must be doing the Rhapsody on a theme by Prokofiev here because it feels just like it. But it's not an overly difficult concerto for the orchestra, but it gives a lot for them to do. So it's not like a Chopin piano concerto where the orchestra doesn't have a very difficult part. I think it's just right, actually, for this type of concert, doing something together for the first time.
Here is a bit of the end of the Third Piano Concerto of Prokofiev. I made a wild guess here. I don't really know if I got anywhere near the point you were suggesting starting. The performer here, the soloist here, is Yevgeny Kissin with the Berlin Philharmonic led by Claudio Abbado. Winston Choi will play it with the Champaign-Urbana Symphony led by Stephen Altop tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Some of the fireworks that you hear at the end of the Prokofiev Third Piano Concerto. Yevgeny Kissin played it with the Berlin Philharmonic led by Claudio Abbado here on Live and Local. I wish he played it here on Live and Local. He wasn't, in fact, here. He was in the CD player. But Winston Choi will play it with the Champaign-Urbana Symphony tomorrow night in a concert that starts at 7:30 and will be conducted by Stephen Altop, who is the fourth and final of the music director finalists for the CU Symphony. At some point after this concert, the search committee or whoever is doing the deliberating will deliberate and come up with a winner. The white smoke will go up and somebody will be chosen. The third piece that's going to be on the program, got to say, is an absolute favorite of mine, the Second Symphony of Jean Sibelius. What made you choose this one?
That's a very good question, because there are certainly easier pieces I could have chosen. But based on what I knew about the orchestra, I thought that it would be a challenging piece. And if we can succeed in putting it together, as I believe we will, then we will have achieved something significant together in our first time to work together. The Sibelius Symphony No. 2 very much reflects Sibelius' genius. It is a motivically intricate piece in that from what he introduces in the very first bar is a building block upon which the whole symphony stands. And so it's the sort of thing that you can analyze, and I have analyzed it rather exhaustively. On the other hand, you don't have to know any of that because audiences like it. And as you said, it's probably his most popular symphony because of its amazing melodies and exciting passages, and in particular, the grand finale that concludes the piece.
Which we will hear some of in a moment. You said that, if we give it a good performance, which of course I'm sure you will, but for any conductor with any orchestra, whether the conductor is with that orchestra regularly or not, but probably especially for a conductor who is not with an orchestra regularly, and potentially, it'll be your one shot and then you're done. If you're successful, it'll be your one shot and then you get a whole lot more. But what are the challenges in your situation, do you think, to fashion a piece like this with just a few rehearsals with people you've probably never seen before?
Well, at this stage of the game, I've conducted many orchestras and many ensembles, and I've conducted this piece a number of times. So I know what the standard challenges are in the Sibelius Symphony No. 2. And I think that it's my job to show the orchestra what things would be like, basically. I need to be demanding. Some conductors approach a situation like this and they're worried about, well, are people going to like me? And it's always nice to be liked. But the most important thing in my work with the orchestra is to seek the highest possible standard. And everything will take care of itself in that way. We will come together in great music, and the whole program has great music, and hopefully serve our audience by giving them a wonderful concert together. And I learned a long time ago that you address what you can control, because as you also probably know as a conductor, there's a lot that you can't control, but you focus on what you can do the very best. So I'm going to give the orchestra the best I can. We will work to make the ensemble excellent, the balance, the intonation, the nuances and interpretation of this piece as I understand it. And we've had two rehearsals so far. We still have two more tonight and tomorrow, and I'm just so looking forward to it. Not to mention the fact that performing in the Krannert Center is going to be amazing. They perform there frequently, but it's actually my first experience standing on that stage, and what an incredible and special acoustic it is.
Yeah, it's although it's really different for the audience than it is for the people on stage. I did it for the second time only, not this past summer, and I remember being shocked when the orchestra started playing. I wanted to know, where did the violins go? So,
well, it's
maybe
not
that'll
uncommon.
Happen, maybe that won't happen.
It's not uncommon that the acoustics are different. They're often, this is why you either go out into the audience or have people out there to listen, because the podium is often not the best place to judge sound. But I know when we finished the Meistersinger Prelude on Wednesday night and this glorious C major chord resounded through the hall, I just practically giggled.
You have rehearsed there already.
We've been really lucky this series in that all of our rehearsals
Fantastic.
Are in the Great Hall.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, that helps a lot. When you
sure does.
In the performance space. Well, Stephen, thanks very much for coming in. I appreciated the chance to talk to you, and I'm sure listeners out there who are following the progress of this search are interested in these conversations, at least I imagine they are, and they'll certainly be interested in hearing the results of your combined labors tomorrow night. Stephen Altaut, music director and conductor finalist with the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra. He'll conduct them on a concert that starts tomorrow night at 7:30 in the Great Hall, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The concert will feature pianist Winston Choi and music by Prokofiev. It'll open with music by Wagner, and it'll end with the Second Symphony of Sibelius. And this is the lead-in to that grand and glorious finale that Stephen referred to earlier. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
That is the first portion of the final movement of the Second Symphony of Jean Sibelius in a performance by the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir Colin Davis. And again, it'll be played by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony tomorrow night, led by Stephen Altaut. The concert starts at 7:30. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. And as a matter of fact, programs today are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting Classics 4 Orchestral Matters, featuring the works of Wagner, Prokofiev, and Sibelius on Saturday, March 9th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets may be purchased online at krannertcenter.com. On Sunday night at 7:30 at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign, there will be a concert presented by the Baroque artist of Champaign-Urbana, Johann Sebastian Bach's Art of the Fugue, one of his last compositions, with plenty of interesting stories, I am sure, about how it came together. It's going to feature two performers, harpsichordist Charlotte Maddox and organist Dana Robinson. They'll be tag-teaming it, as it were, on this piece. And both of them are members of the faculty at the University of Illinois School of Music. Chester Always is music director of the Baroque artist, and in fact will give a pre-concert lecture about this piece. Both gentlemen, just to say, Dana Robinson and Chet Always, are with me here on Live and Local. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Chet, I'll give you the first word. I know that the Baroque artists are best known as orchestra and chorus, maybe especially featuring chorus, but you have, I don't remember how many years ago, started to present concerts that feature a small number of instrumentalists, and I think both of these performers have been on concerts you presented before.
Yeah, actually, the when it began in 96, it was there was no continuous group, and each program was sort of designed around a certain group of people doing a certain kind of music. So we have had smallish chamber performances and various kind of things. Of late, in the last decade particularly, the chorus has moved to the fore, and so that's become a consistent feature. But you're right, we used to do quite a bit of smaller stuff, both so, vocal and instrumental.
So you did more chamber stuff than you did for a while, and have come
we
back
did
to
it, it? Initially, we did much more of that, yeah.
And now?
Now it still happens, but it's not as a steady thing.
So you're giving the pre-concert talk on this piece, which is a piece, I believe, exclusively reserved to instrumentalists, but not any particular instrumentalists for
right.
a specific reason, I think.
Well, that's actually true, and it can be played by a number of different instrumental media, but it's probably, in fact, keyboard music, because all the parts are playable by a single player with just two small exceptions. Everything can be played by two hands without feet, which is the way I'm doing it on the organ. And it's more than likely keyboard music. And a lot of the writing style seems to emerge from just keyboard practice of the time itself. So just the way the hands move at the keyboard often dictates the way the music is laid out and the way it's put together.
But the issue that sort of suggests that potentially anybody could play it is that he didn't say who should play it.
No, he didn't. No, not
so
at all.
One can have license.
Yeah.
Art of the Fugue, I hope I said correctly that it is one of his later or last pieces.
It was the draft. They're playing the autograph version, which is slightly smaller and in a different order than the printed version. The printed version, the autograph dates from 1742, and the printed version was published posthumously, edited by C.P.E. Bach.
So C.P.E., one of the sons of Johann
right,
Sebastian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I read somewhere that in this piece, as well as some of his other later works, he just sort of poured everything he knew about composition, fugue, counterpoint. Are these just big show-off pieces?
Show-off for him?
Compositionally showing off pieces?
I don't think Bach was ever particularly interested in showing off, but he certainly knew what he had, and he knew what he was showing, and he knew that he was showing it for posterity, I think. But there's nothing there as far as showmanship is concerned or musical pyrotechnics, nothing like that.
But there's one theme that is elaborated in a bunch of different contrapuntal
right.
ways for an hour or so.
That's
if
right.
you play the whole thing.
That's right, yeah.
Here's a sample, not on a keyboard instrument, I should say. This is the very beginning of the Art of Fugue. It's called Contrapunctus 1. I'll ask you why coming up. Why Contrapunctus? So think about your answer if you don't know already.
It's fancy.
That was the Amsterdam Lucky Stardust Quartet, a quartet of recorders, here on Live and Local, playing the very beginning of The Art of Fugue by Johann Sebastian Bach, called Contrapunctus 1, a simple fugue on the subject in its original form. I don't know, is that Bach's designation, or is that just what they wrote on? Does
Bach,
he say that?
Bach gave no designation in the original version, no designations at all. So the pieces are just presented and numbered.
So, and no title either. Yeah.
So the contrapuntis, what does that mean and where does it come from?
That was something that was applied to the print that was issued posthumously. And I can't even say whether Bach, whether that's a revision of Bach's adding that as a title or whether that was from the Sons. Do you remember?
I think it was from CPE and the printer.
Yeah.
But it means just counterpoint?
Mm-hmm. It's a fancy Latin word for counterpoint, yeah.
And counterpoint, for those who don't know, means... Yeah, there you go.
You taught it. You explained it.
Yeah, right. It's a texture of music in which individual musical lines are expressed at the same time, and they operate individually. So you can have from two lines up to, well, in the case of Art of Fugue, up to six lines operating at the same time. So six melodies being played at the same time.
And there's lots of different techniques for doing it.
Many.
This one started in one way. And in fact, the way it starts probably suggested to some people a much more famous tune. Bom, bom, beam, bom, 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 bee, dee, dom, you know, an organ
right.
piece.
Yeah.
And so there's your first line. The organist comes in with more or less mm-hmm. the same line mm-hmm. while continuing to play the first line, and then another line. So that's one form of counterpoint is if fugue
right.
of that sort.
Right.
And what are the sorts of things, this risks getting to be a really technical question, but what are the sorts of things that he does to this music, given that for at least 18 tracks on this particular CD, he's just varying one tune for the
right.
whole time.
Well, he also takes the that first theme that he starts out with, the one that you just sang so beautifully.
And, well, I sang the wrong one. I sang the other one.
and he decorates it in various ways and transforms it almost into another theme. But its shape remains. That actually, the farther you get into it, the more he does this.
We are talking about Art of Fugue now.
Yeah, to the point where, you know, 10 pieces in or so, the theme is barely recognizable as it was when he began. So there's a lot of transformation going on the way he decorates. And then he turns it upside down. So it sounds a little bit different when you turn it upside down, obviously.
Not required to be played upside down.
Not required to be played upside down, but he inverts it. And for instance, the one that we're calling number 4 in our order, which is number 5 in the final published version, he starts out with an inverted, decorated version of the theme. And before the theme is finished being played, the answer comes in. So the theme played again. The answer comes in and interrupts the progress of the theme. And this time when the answer comes in, it's in its original position, not the inverted position.
Original position meaning what we heard a bit ago.
But still decorated. So not quite the same.
So if I'm playing, would I be correctly then playing number 5, mm-hmm. Probably mm-hmm. off of this recording?
Mm-hmm.
All right. This recording feature an organist, Lynn Ziegler, playing an organ at Iowa State University. The 5th of the contrapuntices from Art of Fugue by Bach. That was the contrapuntis number 5, part 5 of The Art of Fugue by Johann Sebastian Bach, played by organist Lynn Ziegler. That one will be played by organist Dana Robinson of the University of Illinois in a concert presented by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, Sunday night at 7:30 at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign. Also on that concert will be harpsichordist Charlotte Mattox. They, both Dana and Charlotte, are on faculty at the U of I. And Dana, my guest here on this portion of Live and Local, along with the Baroque Artists' music director, Chet Always. How did you decide, Dana, which of these pieces should be played on the organ at this concert and which should be played on the harpsichord?
Yeah, well, I gave Charlotte all the hard stuff.
That's fair. Does that mean you outrank her? Is that how they go?
No. We look at the pieces, and some of them really beautifully suggest organ because of the use of sustained long notes, and particularly those that seem to be rooted in a vocal keyboard style. So the earliest organ music actually is nothing more than arrangements of vocal music. Mm. And there's a long tradition of composing organ music in that style. And so the first fugue, for example, is very much in that style. It's keyboard music, but it's very closely connected to earlier styles of vocal music.
It could have been sung.
Yeah, and the one that you just played is another example. But then, for example, number six, which is an interesting piece with the theme shown upside down, right side up, and in two different metrical versions, so one twice as long as the other at the same time. But this one is written in the French style, and it's closely inspired by French music of the period, with lots of graceful ornamentation and short notes and dotted rhythms, and it's very idiomatic to the harpsichord and works beautifully.
So people in Bach's day, as you say, I wrote this in this French style, or you don't even tell them you did it in the French style, listeners would recognize it.
Right.
That's
right.
What you had just done.
Yeah.
Here's harpsichordist Robert Hill playing this French-styled portion of Bach's Art of Fugue on Live and Local. Very Frenchy and flowery, that. In the French style, music by Bach, the sixth of the parts of the Art of Fugue, that was played here by harpsichordist Robert Hill. It'll be played by harpsichordist Charlotte Maddox on the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana's concert Sunday night at 7:30 at Grace Lutheran Church on South Prospect Avenue in Champaign. Charlotte will alternate on that concert playing the nearly complete Art of Fugue, I guess, or most of it, with the organist Dana Robinson. If you'd like more information, you can go to baroqueartists.org, and you can buy tickets there, I think, or you can get them at the door.
Yes.
That's the voice of Chester Always, who's music director of the Baroque Artists. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Letting us all know about the concert. Dana, thank you very much for enlightening us about this piece. It can be a really meditative evening, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is. I would say really quickly, it is a life, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Literally, I've heard the piece once in my life.
Through.
Sunday. Yeah. And it's not often performed because it can be perceived, as you saw with that one performance we heard, very metrically and not very interesting. It could be very cerebral. And the question is
and therefore stiff and boring.
Yeah, that's how it's been received historically, is that it's this very cerebral genius level kind of thing, but it still can be beautiful.
As Dana and Charlotte no doubt will demonstrate on Sunday night.
I'm sure they will.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. On the evening concert tonight, as it is every Friday night, it's Prairie Performances, hosted by Roger Cooper, and he'll be broadcasting tonight a concert by the Eastern Illinois University Choral Ensembles and Collegium Musicum, led by Richard Rossi, and that starts at 7 o'clock tonight. Other concerts you can go see and hear live this weekend, I'm going to really cherry pick here because there's a whole lot going on. Kate Myers and Dan Hubbard and the Humidors are going to be at Cowboy Monkey in Champaign tonight at 8:30. It's the Blue G's CD release party with guests Dave Luttrell and Josie Louder at Donnie's Homespun Pizza in Springfield tonight at 7 o'clock. Reverend Robert will be at Orchard Inn in Effingham tonight at 8 o'clock. The Big Creek Guitar Band will be at Huber's in Champaign tonight at 8 o'clock. It's Kate Paradise at Iron Post in Urbana this evening at 5, so starting in just a couple minutes, followed at 8:30 by Samba Soul. Pianist Ian Hobson continues his presentation of the complete solo piano and chamber music with piano of Johannes Brahms at the Krannert Center tonight at 7:30. St. Teresa High School in Decatur presents the musical The Drowsy Chaperone at 7:30 tonight, and that probably continues into the weekend, not sure about that. And Irish flutist Lawrence Nugent with singer and storyteller Tim O'Sullivan will be at the Spurlock Museum this evening, and then later on they'll be at Dublin O'Neill's in downtown Champaign, both of those free. The Danville Symphony will be performing tomorrow night at 7:30 at Danville High School Auditorium. Crackmore, an Irish-Scottish group, will be at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center in Decatur tomorrow night at 7:30. The Shanties will be at Dublin O'Neill's in Champaign tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. In fact, there's an all day of Irish music and dance at the Illini Union of the University of Illinois campus tomorrow from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The Good Lovelies will be at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield Saturday night at 8 o'clock. It's a Black Sacred Music Symposium closing concert at the Krannert Center in Urbana Sunday night at 7:30. And the Parkland Chorus and Wind Ensemble will perform at New Horizon United Church, Methodist Church in Champaign Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And Charlie King and Karen Brando, musical storytellers and political satirists, will be at the Independent Media Center in Urbana Sunday night at 7. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It is 5 o'clock.